The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We skeptics have probably all had this thought at one time or another. What's the link between skepticism and science fiction? We all know it's there. A science fiction movie comes out, and suddenly the online skeptical forums are dominated by discussions of they better not ruin it, and debates over new Spock versus old Spock. And even when the science part is tenuous at best, like in Firefly, we all flock to it like moths to a flame. I myself actually connected with the Edmonton Skeptics community around our weekly Battlestar Galactica gathering. So do skeptics just happen to be really nerdy and like to be entertained, or is there something else there? But before we talk about that, we will start off the show with speaking up. Hello, Jill Powell.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So what would you like to rant about today?
Yes, well, I'd like to discuss two popular horror movies that have supernatural claims around them. The first one is The Omen, which is a horror movie made in the mid-70s about the birth of the devil's son, the Antichrist. This movie and its two sequels dealt with the birth, the rise, and, spoiler alert everyone, the fall of Satan. The second is The Exorcist, which was made around the same time as The Omen, also dealt with the topic of Satan, this time in the form of demon possession of a little girl. Both movies had documentaries about the process of making these films and the supernatural forces that were at work to stop the films from ever being finished, which, as both films were released, clearly were not strong enough. While making The Omen, some of the instances included scriptwriter David Seltzer's plane being struck by lightning. Gregory Peck, in a separate incident, had his plane struck by lightning. A warden at the safari park used in the crazy baboon scene was attacked and killed by a lion the very next day after the crew left. And while making The Exorcist, some of the incidents included the interior sets of the McNeil residence, except for Reagan's bedroom, were destroyed by a studio fire and had to be rebuilt. Blair's harness breaking when she was thrashing around the bed, injuring the actress. The actress playing the mother noted she was slightly hurt when Reagan throws her across the room. And actor Jack McGrowan, who played Burke Dennings, died during filming. The funny thing about these supernatural incidents is if they happen on the set of a movie that didn't involve Satan, say, for example, Good Luck Chuck, would anyone be making a documentary 20 years later about it? Odds are, probably not. This might come as a surprise, but things always don't go smoothly during the making of a film. But that doesn't mean when the harness pulling Linda Blair around breaks, Satan, God, or the ghost of Christmas past was responsible for it. Usually it boils down to human error. Having animals, even trained animals, on the set of movies is no guarantee that the animal will be perfectly behaved at all times. Sometimes animals attack. This doesn't mean that Satan is spurring them on or whispering in their ears saying, "Get him." If you take these incidents out of a horror movie context and put them in a romantic comedy setting, no one would say the movie was cursed or that God or Satan didn't want the film to be made. They would probably say, "Wow, these are an unfortunate set of circumstances that are occurring." Horror movies are clearly meant to frighten people. This much is obvious. But the part to focus on is that they are movies. It's not real. But saying that the movie was cursed and that it didn't get made probably doesn't hurt with the marketing or sales.
So you didn't mention The Crow. Brandon Lee died during that. And so there was a bunch of cursing around this as well. But I guess what I want to know is how many people on set actually believe this stuff? Like, did this make it into the papers, the mainstream papers? Because this is great publicity.
Well, these movies came out in the 70s, and they caused a big uproar due to the content factor and the fact that main characters were children, and they were either possessed by Satan or the Satan's child. But in these documentaries that are shown 20-odd years later, it's interesting to note that the people interviewed are the ones that believe something weird was going on. They have priests that are interviewed, but never is there anyone saying, "Okay, seriously, the reason that this happened was because Johnny didn't do his job properly. It had nothing to do with Satan." So I'm sure there were people on the set and part of the crew who thought nothing supernatural was happening, but you never hear about it because that probably takes away from the mystery surrounding the films.
And it's fairly boring.
Yeah.
And Johnny wouldn't be very happy being, like, publicly humiliated.
Exactly.
Well, I'm thinking, Also, attributing any problems to the supernatural is probably a great excuse.
Yes.
Like on set, if you show up late, Satan prevented me from coming. Satan ruined my equipment. Satan ate the last donut.
It's true.
I think that's probably a lot more interesting, at least.
Yeah.
But it only works for scary movies, like Good Luck Chuck. So, like, not Good Luck Chuck, rather. But, well, actually, that was kind of a scary movie in
yeah,
itself.
Yeah, in itself, in a different sense.
Totally different. So, but, like, Jill, you've been on sets before. So, how many, you know, I assume there are problems on a regular basis?
Well, as a general disclaimer to the audience, I haven't actually been involved in making short films or actually been on a professional movie set for a while.
Ooh, so even more problems.
Yes, even more
Yay.
Problems. And there are more knowledgeable people about that, knowing about that than myself. But generally, things never go according to plan. Props go missing or break. Actors bail or are actually quite terrible. The script needs reworking. The location needs to be changed.
Did you blame it on Satan?
No. The budget is not enough for the equipment. But no one has ever, that I have ever been involved with, or no people who have been on film has ever said, well, this didn't work out. So clearly, this is the work of the devil.
Never?
Never.
That's kind of disappointing, actually. You could also use the Satan thing if everything went well. You know, like that's publicity for an entirely different subset of the population. It's like the movie was so easy to film. Satan obviously wants you to see it. That actually works with those little kids wearing black.
It's
the
true.
Angsty ones.
It's true.
Good.
It's true.
We actually had a website comment before the show, and it's totally not related. But I find it really interesting. Butterfly Cake, who sometimes comments on the website, she said, when I bring my city friends out to my parents' place in the country, there's a part on the drive where there's 2 miles of forest-lined gravel road. They almost always make the comment, I feel like I'm in a horror movie, or make a joke about someone with a chainsaw and a hockey mask jumping out of the woods. It seems that horror movies give viewers a higher exposure to the outdoors than other genres. This is a possible contributor to nature deficit disorder. And she might be onto something there. Do you think that scary movies make people less likely to go outside?
Maybe. I mean, whenever my parents live out in the country, and whenever I house sit for them, I'm totally alone and isolated. So there's never not a time when I don't think to myself, man, this seems familiar somehow, and how I wish my parents had a big dog instead of a lazy cat to protect me. But then I go to sleep, and I wake up in the morning clearly not decapitated.
Yay!
Hooray! As for the woods scenario or the outdoor scenario, I don't like going into the woods because there are bears.
Right.
And not because of ghosts, demons, or insane axe murderers with hockey masks. I just don't want to be eaten by a bear. And the last time I checked, bears were real.
It's a good point, Jill, with the real bears.
Yes.
If anyone reads Jill's Twitter feed, she's at Jillis. And she talks frequently about bears. She is totally not joking.
I'm not.
Now, I don't really like the outdoors either, but that's because there's usually really crappy wireless.
Yes.
You can't get a signal up there.
No, you
there's
can't.
No point. So maybe in the short term, though, it would frighten people away from going outdoors. Like, you probably don't want to go for a walk in the woods right after you watched Halloween, what are we on, 27?
Yeah, Halloween 27, redone by Rob Zombie for the fifth time. I mean, I can understand that. Like, after I watch a horror movie, of course you're going to... you're going to hear every creak in the house, or like if you're by yourself, you know, wonder. But then you have to do this thing called thinking and realize that what you just watched, the odds of it happening are very slim. So you just have to relax and enjoy what you watched.
I think that's a good place to end that. Good. Relax. So thanks for being here, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
So Jill is not the only one that we let rant on Speaking Up. Everyone's invited. Come and talk about your favorite irrational behavior, pseudoscience, or urban myth. This segment's actually also a great way to promote your event or your group or whatever you happen to be doing. So if anyone out there wants to appear on Speaking Up, send us an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Tell us briefly what your topic would be. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, send it off, and we'll get back to you. And we'll be right back to talk about science fiction and skepticism after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, @skepticalradio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're here today with podcaster and programmer Derek Colanduno, co-host of Skepticality, the official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. He grew up in Las Vegas and now lives in Atlanta, and I would assume that means he acts as almost this sole bastion of reality in both those places. In 2005, during a keynote address, Apple CEO Steve Jobs mentioned Skepticality as one of the top 9 podcasts at the iTunes Music Store. And a little over an hour after that comment, Derek suffered a stroke. He was in a coma for 6 weeks and had 6 months of rehab, which was recounted for the listeners by his co-host Robin Swoopy McCarthy. He's had an asteroid named after him in honor of him pioneering the new media of podcasting and putting it to service for skeptical thinking. And then post-stroke, to make us all feel like whiny slackers, he started the Skeptical Fan Track at DragonCon. Thanks very much for being here, Derek.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, how are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Good.
Seems exciting to be here.
Oh, good, thank you. We're very happy to have you.
Okay.
So start us off with what the DragonCon SkepTrack is, for those who don't know.
Well, if you've never been to DragonCon, and you know, many sci-fi or fantasy or any type of con that's kind of fan-ish for like movies or TV or books or anything, a lot of time the larger cons have tracks or segments of a topic area. And DragonCon has about 55 of them, ranging from science and skeptic stuff or fantasy or making your own costumes or learning about movies or what's on TV now. So they have many, many buckets of things you can go to. So if you go to like DragonCon, you can never even see anything reality. You can hole up in all the fantasy stuff and never even know there's a skeptic track. So DragonCon usually gets between 40 or 50,000 people every year that get the all 4-day pass. So it's pretty big and it's not a small party, but it's a very fun party.
It is. But why hold a skeptical conference at a science fiction convention?
Well, you know, it's funny that when we started our show, Drew Myers and Rain, who did the science and space tracks of DragonCon, they liked our show, and they had me and Swoopy come to DragonCon, and we talked on one of their, well, it was kind of what became the debate. We didn't have one this year, but, and we talked about Carl Sagan and skeptic stuff in relation to science. And then we also, it was the first year they had anything to do with podcasting. Mm. So it was kind of like that weird little intersection that just hit at the same time, where our show was really popular on iTunes. We were number one for a very long time. And then also the skeptic stuff, because of our show, got interest from the people who ran the stuff at DragonCon, including the guy who runs DragonCon, because he's kind of skeptic himself. And so once Drew had us do that debate, I asked a bunch of the big name skeptics at TAM if they might be interested in coming to DragonCon, and a bunch of them did. So in 2005, Shermer and Jeff Wagg and Phil Plait, a lot of people that are big in the skeptic movement, came to just be on some panels on the science track and things like that. And every single event that those people were on, the room was so packed that a couple times the fire marshal actually shut down the room and pushed people out. So
awesome.
Then the next year, 2006, they asked if we could do a full track. Now, of course, the funny part is that came about while I was in a coma. So Swoopy said yes. And she figured, you know, I'd be better by then, or she would have to do it herself.
Well, I attended this year, and it was amazing. Absolutely.
Thank you.
I encourage everyone listening to attend next year. And it's actually a very intimate skeptical conference.
You would think from hearing how big it is, mm-hmm. it wouldn't be. But one of the things that DragonCon tries to do, we've tried the convention itself, as big as it is, a lot of people are confused every time they want to come. They're like, why is it in hotels? It's got to be like all packed up in different areas. You have to walk from hotel to hotel. And in the past, DragonCon was trying to figure out where it fit best. And it did try the big conference centers, like they do for like a Comic-Con and things like that, or other conventions where they have bigger spaces. And they've tried that in different places. The problem is DragonCon gets that intimate feeling you talked about because it's in hotels, because you have to go to smaller venues to see everything. So you don't really ever get that feeling like you're in a big crowd all the time.
Right.
You do it when you're in between events, which is like, oh, I always forget there's all these people out here, because you only get to see events like in smaller rooms, even though they're fairly big, small rooms, but they're not like a huge, massive convention center.
Well,
it feels that way on purpose.
Do you also think, though, that that the SkepTrack is more inclusive just because DragonCon is, excuse me, is more inclusive? Because DragonCon is fairly inclusive. Full-grown men in Wookiee costumes is about as inclusive as you can get.
Everything from like little kids to people that are very handicapped, and everybody's very nice to everybody, which is, you know, always something cool to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, sorry, continue.
Oh no, I was saying, I mean, you're right, because you'll see people who are handicapped, and other people that are attending the conference actually help them.
Yeah. I did notice that a lot, actually. So how many people that attend DragonCon just sort of wander into the SkepTrack? I realize that's very difficult to track.
I can't tell you a number, but I get it all the time. Last year and this year, I had a bunch of people came in and told me, oh, I've been here for like the past three panels, and I was supposed to be over there with my friends, but next year I'm going to have to plan to be here most of the time. So I got a lot of that.
So the people attending DragonCon already love science fiction. So do you think they're more likely to be interested in skepticism than the rest of the population? More easily recruitable?
You know, this comes up quite a bit, especially lately. It's hard. It's very easy to like link that off the top of your head, because so many people that are names in skeptics circles that are really like sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of them also like a lot of the fantasy stuff as well. Like, I know Steven Ovella, he is in the past, and he might still write supplements for things like Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. That's fantasy. And I'm not sure if it's just the sci-fi part, if it's just the creative mindset that, you know, creative stuff is usually where people who think like skeptics might go, just because of the part of the nature of what you have to do to be involved with either games or fantasy or sci-fi. I think it's just the part of your brain that it caters to more than, because you can't link sci-fi with skeptic stuff really, because a lot of the big name writers actually wrote their TV shows or movies for something very woo.
This is a very good point. We're going to continue exploring that. Anybody out there, if you have a question about the SkepTrack or recruiting from the ranks of sci-fi fandom, do call us at 780-492-2577, extension 1. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So, You're talking about science fiction writers, and you're right. Not all of them are skeptics, but some are self-identified skeptics.
Oh yeah, so I mean, there's people like Michael Stackpole, mm-hmm. or Scott Sigler, even though he's sci-fi horror, but you know, still sci-fi really. Although it's not really sci-fi because everything he writes is actually not fiction. It's actually stuff that can actually happen, but it feels like sci-fi. So it's, I lump it in there, but it's not really fiction. It's kind of real,
right?
Which makes it even more freaky. But you know, if you look in the past, it, some of the big, you know, sci-fi stuff, a lot of people might not realize this, but like the man who created Battlestar Galactica, he actually wrote that show. Originally it was called Adam's Ark, and it was a whole series. It was originally sci-fi on purpose, but it was a vehicle to promote Mormon thought.
Right.
You know, and then the network forced him to change the name because who would watch a sci-fi show with the name Adam's Ark about religious stuff? So they washed it away, but it's still the same exact story. So you can actually get that, especially when they turn back the clock to that era when they finalized the new rewrite of Battlestar. A lot of people got really mad about the final, you know, episodes. I was like,
even get me started.
But you know what? You can't be mad. You can only be mad at yourself because that was where the whole thing was leading up to from the beginning.
So, okay, we've established that that science fiction is not inherently skeptical. So you're saying there is skeptical and non-skeptical science fiction?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course. I mean, look at Dianetics, which, you know, now we have Scientology. He was a sci-fi writer.
Right. So that's we have Battlefield Earth.
Yes.
I have to do it. So is Star Trek skeptical and is Star Wars skeptical?
Okay. I love this one. Okay. Star Wars, that I would think is not skeptical. I think that caters to, I wouldn't say things like, you know, Mormon or you think any typical pigeonholed religion type thing, but it definitely is New Age in a way. But I think that really was just there because it was a good story in my mind. I don't think it was meant in any way. It was just supposed to be good. So I'm not sure that even is in the same thing. I consider Star Wars space opera.
Gotcha.
So it's not, I don't know where to lump that, you know, in a way.
Well, the Force was New Age. But
yeah,
then,
that's what I'm saying, yeah.
Then they tried to give it a science background later.
Yeah, which is a really mistake. They should never tried to explain that away.
Were they trying to make it more skeptical, do you think?
No, I just think they were trying to, like, I don't know. You never know what's going on in the mind of George Lucas. So,
oh, let's not even go there. No.
Yeah, so no. If you're asking me to, like, figure out that man's mind, I'm not going to do it. He came up with Jar Jar. Come on.
I know. Painful, really. So why is Star Trek skeptical then?
Well, you know, it was written as a humanist vehicle. The whole, you know, if you actually pay attention to the canon of Star Trek, it's very humanist. The whole storylines are meant that way. When they deal with religion, it's in that very, the context of, you know, not reality, but in a very real manner. Like the Vulcans were religious, but not really religious. They were more spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't religious, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
You know, and it was very much a humanist, you know, written show. I think on purpose, I know the author was. So I'm not sure he consciously did it that way. And I think a lot more skeptics are big fans of Star Trek. And a lot of them like Star Wars, but I don't think they revere it as much as they do Star Trek. At least that's in my experience. I've met a lot of skeptics who don't even care about sci-fi at all.
Really?
So, you know, it's you know.
Sorry, that's stunning to me.
Well, you know, it's easy for us to like feel that way because that's around the people we hang out with in a way. But you know, I've met a lot of people who huge skeptics who don't care about sci-fi. Here's one, for example. My father, huge skeptic, probably more than me. You have no idea. And my dad hates sci-fi completely.
That's you know, we you knew this would happen. We actually have an email question now on Star Trek.
Yes.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Kirk versus Picard.
That is the whole question.
Wow. Which version of Kirk?
Oh, that was not specified, emailer. Okay, well, you choose.
Well, okay. Let's go. I've always preferred, you know, it's weird to say this, but I've always preferred Picard. I think he was written better. And I think it's because he's a better actor, which is less to do with the less to do with the character, less more to do with the acting. And after I got to meet for a very brief period of time at Dragon Con this year, I got to meet Shatner a little bit, and like, I'm not impressed anymore.
Ooh, Shatner, if you're listening, because I'm assuming that Shatner listens to my show. That's a
challenge.
You know,
the thing is, I like Shatner's work, especially his newer work. He's been amazing. Like on Boston Legal, was just knock out the park. I mean, it was amazing. But you know, he was prickly at Dragon Con. Maybe that's not him all the time, but maybe it's because he was around Nimoy. I've heard there's things between them, but they seem fine at the con. I have no idea.
They're being paid an awful lot of money to be fine as well. So how bad does the skepticalness in a movie or TV show have to be before you just can't enjoy it anymore?
It depends. Like, here's a weird one. I've said this before on other interviews, so it doesn't bother me. My wife, who's a big skeptic, my God, she is. And, you know, she likes a good story. And I don't like the show, but she just likes to watch what she calls filler TV, the stuff that's entertaining enough.
Right.
That's not complete crap, which she watches a lot of that too, just to like fill her time. Anyway, she watches that Ghost Whisperer show. She just likes, it's just mindless entertainment to her. And, you know, I'm like, you know, this, I mean, the thing was, it's co-produced by James Vrag Prague, who he believes all that stuff.
Which, right.
I mean, it's amazing. But, you know, she doesn't care. She's like, it's just entertainment, you know? And in a way, that's probably the best way to handle all of this when it's entertainment, because that's what it is. We've actually, on our show, we've talked to people who've created and write, you know, TV shows that are, you know, science-based skeptic shows. But they warn us every time that there's times where they have to write things a little bit different, even though they always stay true to science. But they can't go as far as they want to because they are reminded all the time by the people who give the money that it is just entertainment. You can't preach. You can't, you know, make it too smart. You have to make sure there's light enough for everybody else to not care about anything but being entertained.
Right.
And that's the thing you have to keep in the back of your mind, which is hard to do. You know, I think that's the thing that makes Mythbusters so amazing to me. Because they get away with doing hard science, and it's amazing to watch. And they get away with it, and nobody knocks it down. So it is. Somebody needs to find the best way to handle that. You know, and there's been some shows that have been decent about that. circle back to Battlestar Galactica. Now, the original Battlestar was written by, was it Larson, I guess the guy's name was? And he's the one who created Adam's Ark, which became Battlestar. And that was written as, you know, the whole story of, you know, the Mormons. And, you know, that's how they 13 tribes, and they got sent off to, like, do their journey to find, in the reality world, would be Salt Lake City. But, you know, that's the kind of the idea behind it.
Right.
But, you know, when the new producer and the guy with money said, let's redo this completely, he hired, you know, really good science advisors. Kevin Grazier, who comes to Dragon Con every year, he was the science advisor on Battlestar, and he's done many talks there. He said, you know, he reviewed so much of that science and talked about things that people saw who they thought, well, that can't have happened, and he said, this is how it actually could have. So that show, until the wrap up, all of it was pretty scientific, and it wasn't until they had to like get to the logical conclusion of keeping the story true to its roots, you know, it was pretty scientific, you know, so there's ways to do it, but it's hard to like, you know, expect too much from your fiction, even when it's very much science based.
And that's a good point. We want to expect a lot from it. And actually, on that point, Kylie Sturgis sent in an email question. And hopefully you're all reading Kylie Sturgis's blog.
Oh, she's fun.
Absolutely. It's podblack.com. And Kylie's part of the Skeptic Zone podcast and also an amazing researcher.
And she also is on my staff.
And she's also on your staff.
For DragonCon.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Didn't you see her doing my staff-like stuff?
I just thought she was really busy and really involved.
She was doing the work.
Oh, well, good to know. Wow, that woman's busy. Okay, so she wrote a fantastic post on this topic, actually, and it is chock full of links to articles and studies. So if you're looking for where I got a lot of the information for this show, check her blog. But to her question, go ahead, Ryan.
Derek, since Michael Crichton has been promoted at a Skeptic conference, the one held by Skeptic.com in 2006, and was criticized for his views on global warming, is it really possible to draw the line about what makes a good pro-science science fiction writer? Continuing with this example, can we say that his other works, like Jurassic Park, ER, and so forth, which have indeed encouraged an interest in science across a range of ages, need to be taken on a case-by-case basis? And does Crichton get a pass while another arguably popular fantasy, sci-fi, contemporary author, Whitley Strieber, with his 2012 Apocalypse Tales and Alien Abduction Accounts, does not?
Wow. You know.
Thoughts?
Well, the thing is, I think everybody focuses on that one part of Crichton's work when he came out, railed against global warming. I think that's where most of that comes from, for the most part. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's one of those things where I think that debate's going to be going on. The whole global warming thing is going to probably be going on for a little while longer. And the hard part about that is it's because it's such a slow process. And even science-minded people sometimes have a big problem with very slow-moving ships.
That's a really good point.
You know, and if you remember, you can, on places like Hulu or YouTube, you can go back and find, search for Carl Sagan's clips that he's done during the 70s and 80s for different TV shows or on his own. And he talked about global warming back in like the late 70s or early 80s. And that clip is on YouTube. And, you know, he talked about it then.
Right.
And people were arguing about it with him then. And that's one of the reasons why he never got into the Academy. You know, because people thought he was trying to popularize science and talking about things that were way too off the ledge. And so I don't think this debate's even close to being done. We're a little bit further along, but it's going to be a hard one. And it's very difficult to do that. I mean, it's hard to like say, because you don't believe in this, you're not a skeptic anymore.
Right.
Here's a good example. Hal Bidlack, who's the MC at all the TAM events. You know, he's a deist, but he's a skeptic. Mm-hmm. But if people want to, because a lot of skeptics are atheists, right? Well, there's so many of them that are. What if they just wrote off Hal because, you know, he doesn't agree with them in that one particular area? I think that's a mistake.
You know, we should have an entire show on just defining our terms. What is a skeptic?
That's difficult to say.
Yeah, it is. So if you out there in audience land want to talk to Derek about science fiction movies, not climate change, other things, please do call in. The number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So let's talk about the science connection, because skepticism and science are practically synonymous at certain points.
Well, you can't have one without the other.
Right. So ideally, usually being both evidence-based. So does science fiction help science? Like, does it make it more interesting, first of all?
I think it can. In certain cases, it can. But it depends on the show. A lot of people have said that things like CSI help a lot, mm-hmm, because people get interested in the science they're doing. Whether or not it's right or good, I'm not going to talk about that, because, you know, you get some, it's like Mac versus PC sometimes. But the thing is, it gets people involved with, you know, the idea of science and they get involved with it. And I've met some people who have decided to go into college and have some form of science as their major because of things on TV or things they've read in fiction that was good. And they thought, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me do that for a living.
Right.
So I think it helps quite a bit.
But, well, Kylie's post, actually, that I was speaking of mentions a government report on the influence of science fiction on science and technology education, levels and attentiveness. And it was from the USA's Science and Engineering Indicators of 2002, Science Fiction and Pseudoscience. It turns out that 30% of those participating in the 2001 National Science Foundation survey said that they read science fiction books or magazines. Now, I guess that really only tells us that engineers are sci-fi geeks too, but it's not really causation necessarily. But like you say, a lot of what the study did say is a lot of scientists say that they started in their fields because of their interest in science fiction. So why do you think that is? Is it because they want to know if these things are actually possible, or?
I think they just were attracted to it. It was a good story. Like I said, with Mythbusters, that's a great, they're doing a great job because they're making it interesting. And that's why, I mean, if you think back when you're young enough to like go, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? You're not going to like pick, you know, something really lame.
So that's, I think you answered my question. You're not going to pick something really lame. So whatever looks not really lame is probably what you're going to want to get into.
So yes, if you're getting really good science on TV or a really good science fiction story with decent science in it, you know, people wouldn't say, well, hey, mom, I want to do that for a living. And she's like, well, you have to become a biologist or a chemist or whatever. And, you know, I think it helps quite a bit. Because that's what really matters, right?
Right. Actually, we have a couple of emails piling up here. Go ahead, Ryan.
Hey, this email is from Marion. She asks, which is your favorite sci-fi book with a skeptical bent?
Oh, God. I didn't think about that. Well, you know, I'm going to have to admit something here, because this is something that baffles Swoopy and my wife. I'm looking at all the books I've read in for the past, you know, almost 10 years. I've seen like one or two books that are fiction from authors I know, from like people like Stock Sigler, but I did the science review in his books. Mm-hmm. So I read them. All the rest of them are nonfiction books.
That's not bad. That's I think that's admirable.
Well, the thing is there's something that to be said for, you know, escaping now and then. But I don't know why. It's always been me. I've always never been attracted to the fiction books. I've always been attracted to the nonfiction books. I mean, in my girl's closet, when my wife met me, she got a little afraid because I had the entire set of these books that show you how things are really done for writers.
Even though
I wasn't much of a writer, but I just found it interesting. They had a book about poison, a book about how to kill somebody and, you know, hide the body. But that's their writer's guides, right? But I love to read them because they're science. You know, they shows you exactly how a DNA test is done and how the process of how it happens and things. So I love that stuff. And my wife thought it was amazing that everything in my closet was either, you know, a game book, or it was something like that. It was going to be like, you know, a book about science or these novel things that are just there to show you how the real world works, or how to, like, you know, hide a body. You know, she thought it was weird. But, you know, that's always been my thing. I just always have liked the reality stuff.
Don't worry, Derek. I'm not fun either. We we have an email.
2012 is coming up. Is it going to delegitimize the 2012 myths by fictionalizing them as what will most likely be the most ridiculously over-the-top disaster porn ever created, or is it going to increase belief in them?
Okay, this is a fun one. So here's what's going to happen, I think. This is going to happen.
Ooh, I think prophecy time.
2012 will happen, and people will say, like they did with the year 2000, everything's going to, you know, fall apart. No, it didn't. So now we've moved it to 2012 because the Mayans, I guess, back in the day, said something weird, which they didn't say something weird. They just have a calendar and it, you know, it flips over. Ours does it every year. Okay, whatever. So 2012 will happen and nothing weird will happen. But I've already seen it. What's going to happen? Because I've already seen many people have already been saying, well, you know, it could be wrong. Because if you look at it this way, it's actually, you know, 2024. All right, now it'll be, oh, no, it's 2250. I've already seen this.
Yeah.
So they're gonna move it again. It's like when, you know, a psychic says, this is going to happen on this date. Well, no. I didn't say it would be exactly that day. So they'll just move it again.
So, well, let's go with that for a second, with pseudoscience. A lot of people can't really figure out the difference between movies and reality, apparently. And, you know, even Jill was talking about this on Speaking Up. For example, the science and engineering indicator study that I mentioned, they point out that scientists and others believe that the media, and in particular the entertainment industry, may at least be partially responsible for the large numbers of people who believe in astrology, ESP, alien abductions, and other forms of pseudoscience. Because not everyone who watches shows with pseudoscientific themes perceives such fare as merely entertaining fiction, there is a concern that the unchallenged manner in which some mainstream media portrays pseudoscientific phenomena has exacerbated the problem and contributed to the public's scientific illiteracy.
But, you know, here's the problem. It goes back to my thing. It's entertainment. And what are you going to do, really? Because people aren't going to buy, you know, movie tickets to, you know, a documentary until, you know, Michael Moore proved that wrong. But, you know, is that science? I don't think so. But, you know, it comes down to that. I think it more comes down to stuff like that we're doing. You know, you have this radio show. You're hoping that one or two people will hear it and get interested that weren't involved with Skeptic anything.
Exactly.
And they'll go, this is fun. I can go with this. And they get involved. And it's happened with our show quite a bit. People have sent us emails and said, you know, I never thought about this. And I saw it on a blog post or in a Google alert, and so I listened to the show, and I thought it was fun, and I kept listening, and I'm now a big fan. So I think that's where the meat really is. You have to get the aura effect, which is what, you know, people like Apple did. They made an iPod, which is all they made at the beginning, and they started to make all these other things, you know, that were involved with that little pod device, and then for people say, well, I wonder if their computer's good too.
That's a good point. Audience, again, if you want to get involved in the conversation about science fiction and technology with Derek Colanduno of Skepticality fame, call us at 780-492-2577, extension 1. Email us at live at Skeptically Speaking or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we're going to get back to those calls and emails right after this.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking with Paul Ingraham, a registered massage therapist and science writer who criticizes questionable practices in alternative healthcare. But his professional regulator calls it offensively unprofessional and wants to censor his website. Science-based alternative health, rebellion within the alt-health ranks, all this and more on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Derek Colanduno, co-host of the podcast Skepticality. Now, I just want to remind people, we mentioned it last show, I'd like to say it again, that we're looking for a new theme song for Skeptically Speaking. So if you have any musical talent whatsoever and access to some good recording equipment, we want your help. So write us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com for more details. And FYI, the deadline for submissions will be the end of this year. So, Derek, I was thinking about this before the show. Is science fiction useful to explore the ethics around new technology before it happens? Because that happens in quite a few movies.
I think that's been the stomping ground of science fiction almost from the beginning. I mean, look at the older even movies or books. They've all been that gray area line where they're trying to explore something that might be either ethical or Where if you look back at like things like The Day the Earth Stood Still, I mean, look at the message behind that, the original one, not the new one.
Purist.
Yeah, it's a little bit different.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's just been always been there with science fiction. It's a great place to do it because you have the chance to explore all these ideas, which are very obvious, but you're never pinning down reality to offend anybody. So you get a wider audience and then you get people to think about it. Because once you offend somebody, their brain shuts off and they're not going to talk about anything or listen to it at all.
Right. So to what extent does sci-fi inspire real science and engineering? Like, have there been technologies that first appeared in science fiction?
The Star Trek phone?
Mm-hmm.
The flip phone? Come on. Star Trek. It happens all the time. Yeah, things like, you know, the idea of a submarine that first was in a sci-fi book.
Was it?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of things were sci-fi first just because somebody created them in their head and then other people said, that's cool, let me make that. So I think it happens. I'm not sure it often happens on purpose. I just think it happens.
So do you think that those things would have been invented in the first place without science fiction?
It's hard to say. I mean, things like the Star Trek phone, I think it would have, because it actually solved a problem. But I think the problem that the solution they found probably maybe wouldn't have happened without somebody saying, well, some marketing person said, you know, that's a good idea. Somebody probably said in the boardroom, we can solve this problem if you make it like a foldable phone. And some marketing person said, like Star Trek, we can sell that. So
that was beautiful.
But I'm sure that happens. You know, but I don't think it ever happens on purpose. You know, like many things, it just happens because of the sci-fi, the nature of sci-fi, because it has to go well beyond the edges of reality on purpose to make it interesting. Otherwise, it's not sci-fi, it's reality. So it has to like go out there and find things that don't exist.
Now we have another email, and I love this. Every time this show talks about movies, that's where we get the majority of the emails. So go ahead, Ryan.
After that final episode, would you consider Battlestar Galactica skeptical or non-skeptical science fiction?
Well, I think I kind of answered that at the beginning.
You kind of did. I think that person showed up late.
Yeah. Well, like I said before, the whole show was written originally as a whole study in, you know, religion. And it never really was a skeptic show. It's just that when they did the new show, they wanted to make sure that things were cool. And they wanted to have, like, space without sound, which is, like, my big pet peeve. So I love that. And they wanted to make sure what was going on in the show was fairly, reality. So they had a really good science, you know, advisor with their show. But the story and the main crux of the message of the story of the show was not skeptical.
So you don't think we have to worry about presenting shows that are skeptical or non-skeptical? You don't think we have to worry about that as long as it's entertaining? Because, people still do get confused, it seems.
I don't think I would say that.
Okay.
I would say the fact is we have to be more creative to be able to have a highly entertaining show or book or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And be, you know, skeptical at the same time. It's hard to do. But if you want to just write things off because they're not skeptical, it'll be a very lonely world for a while. So you have to encourage entertainment and media that is, you know, skeptical, mm-hmm. and reality based, and promote it. Like I said before, Mythbusters is amazing. It's great for that. There's other shows that people don't think of as being that way, but, you know, like the Dirty Job show is kind of like that as well. Even though they don't do science or anything, it's just, it's highly entertaining, and they show people doing real things, you know, in a real job. And sometimes it is science. They've been to dinosaur bone digs as part of the show. So you have to be creative, but you can't hammer somebody over the head with a frying pan and make them believe or like skeptic stuff. It's sad because they're not going to do that. Well, you have to rope them in.
How do we help with that? Because agreed, there are tons. I watch horror movies a lot, so there are tons of examples of non-skeptical, really fun movies. So do we have to be the person in the theater saying things like, you know, you realize given the speed and the trajectory, the craft wouldn't turn that way, because that's potentially really annoying. Although Phil Plait did that after Star Trek, and that was awesome. That was a great post. But do we have to be those people?
Well, it kind of funny. You mentioned Phil Plait. I think he has like the best tact to it of all. You know, he even said in that post where he tore apart the new Star Trek, is it, you know, it doesn't matter because he enjoyed the movie. And I think that's the big part. That's the big part. And sometimes we do have to be the person that says, well, that really wouldn't happen. Because that's how the myths happen that people believe. And our skepticality at the beginning, that was our show. We talked about things that people thought were real.
Exactly.
Because of pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And corrected them. You know, things like, you know, if somebody fires a gun in an airplane, it blows up or, you know, sucks everybody out. It doesn't happen. Or, you know, when there's a car crash on a movie, it doesn't matter what's going on. It blows up like a bomb. And it's like, think that about that for like 1 second, then every rush hour, it'd be like, you know, the war in Iraq.
Right.
So, you know, you have to present things. When things happen all the time that people believe, you should correct that. But you don't have to like be, you know, the downbrow that makes everybody go, well, you made this not fun.
I frequently am that person. Ryan, we have another email question.
This question is from David. He asks, do you feel that there is a difference between science fiction that is clearly fiction, such as Star Trek, Star Wars, and others set in the future, and science fiction that takes place in today's world, such as The X-Files, Fringe, and so on? My feelings as a skeptic have been that the former is okay because it's clearly fiction, while the latter seems to try to tap into existing conspiracy nonsense, which tends to annoy me when I try to watch it.
Yeah, he feels the same as I do. Even though I think X-Files was okay toward the end a little bit just because the story got better. But, you know, should fiction be responsible for what people are going to think on their own? And that's a tough one because I've thought about that too. It's like, well, but should it matter? I mean, should it be the TV show's fault that those people believe that? And it's hard to do. I mean, can you really do that with, you know, keep people entertained or keep their show on the air? I think it can be written in a better way, but that would take a skeptic writer, which there aren't too many of them. And like I said before, if you promote and endorse and scream and shout about the stuff that actually is good, that you like, that stuff will become the stuff that the writers and the producers want to see because it made money.
Right.
And I think that's the best way to handle it. You can't grouse about it on your own. You just have to get people to watch it or be involved or write in. That's the best thing to do. You don't think that, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, writing into like a movie studio or a newspaper or whatever doesn't have effect. It does. They read that stuff. And, you know, it's amazing that they do. I mean, I've written networks before, and every single time I've done it, and sometimes it takes a couple months, but I've gotten a response.
But I'd like to point out it didn't work for Firefly.
It almost did.
I know.
That's why we have
just
a movie.
I'm very sad. That's true. Well, that's a good point. We got a movie out of that.
Yeah, and although I like TV shows much better than movies for the most part,
because
you get to have a story for a long time. And although, you know, here's an example where it did work. X-Files, which you mentioned before, it was canceled after the first season. And it came back within, like, by the time the next season came around because everybody wrote in.
Okay, so hear that, people?
So you can affect things.
Absolutely.
So if you're a skeptic and you really are passionate about that, write in. Even if it's stupid. Like if you see something on TV, go, oh, that's great. I wish they would do that more. Send them a letter. Say, hey, by the way, I love this segment. Find out who the writer of the show is or the producer. You know, the writers and the producers are the best people to find the emails or the contact information for because they care the most. And they're the ones that make things happen because the other people are just on a board somewhere and they go, it's all money to them. Not, you know, they don't care much about, you know, the fans as much as they do the money. They don't care about the fans to keep them, but to them, you know, they're numbers. But the people who produce and write the shows, they're the ones that you have to get to.
How about the actors? Do the actors have any say in that?
No, I've heard a mixed bag there. So to me, I wouldn't even bother. You know, here's a good one. We've talked to them on our show. The people who created and write Numbers, the TV
right.
show,
mm-hmm.
and they're huge skeptics. Mm-hmm. In fact, they've worked with Michael Shermer a few times to like clean up some of the stuff on their show. And you know, they were telling us. I'm not sure. I don't think it was actually on the show, but we did ask them about that. You know, and there's a few of the actors that are completely woo, even though they've turned around one or two of them actually by telling them, no, read this book or
no,
that's not really true. And
yeah.
But a lot of the actors, they have odd and bizarre beliefs. And if you want to, you can't worry about the actors. I think really the writer is really matters.
Well, that's what we're doing here, trying to change the world one step at a time. Sometimes
yeah.
actors, sometimes people watching the actors. But this is our time for tonight, Derek. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Oh, gosh, that went bad fast.
An hour goes quick, hey?
It does, doesn't it?
So you can hear Derek on the other side of the mic on his podcast, Skepticality, at skepticality.com.
And we also have a new sister podcast at Skepticality. We have Monster Talk.
Absolutely.
With Karen Slosnow and Blake.
And that just got picked up by Skeptic, did it not?
Yep, it did.
Perfect.
Right before Halloween with monsters.
Brilliant timing. As usual. You in the audience can visit our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, join our Facebook page, or follow us on Twitter. And if you're listening via podcast right now, maybe you'd like to check out a live episode, which is sometimes quite different. It allows you to watch us while we're on air, which is vaguely creepy for me, but you might like it. There's a countdown clock on the website that shows you exactly how long it is until the next live episode, and just click the Listen Online link. I also just want to say thanks to the Skeptically Speaking team. Although they're not front and center, they make the show something that people actually want to listen to, which is awfully nice. So thanks to Jarrett, who's in charge of the tech wizardry, Mike on the soundboard, Ryan, who's our phone, Twitter, email guy, and who also does some research for me. Grant, who does the video work and secondary Skype finagling. I may have just made that term up. Jill, who takes care of the Ustream feed, who will also give you a stern talking to if you misbehave in the chat room. And Josh, who maintains the website. It's a big team for a little radio show, and it would not be possible without everyone here. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Sometimes fall up, but you never see, and everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government.